I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
I think this is a victory for dialogue, a victory for peace, offering significant good news for today's turbulent world.
Iran and Saudi Arabia have agreed to restore diplomatic ties after 4 days of secret meetings in Beijing. We'll look at what this means for the Middle East and China's growing role in the region. Then we go to North Pole, Alaska, as President Biden moves to approve a massive oil and gas development in northern Alaska known as the Willow Project. Then to East Palestine, Ohio, as senators grill the CEO of Norfolk Southern over the company's toxic train derailment.
You talked about covering the needs of the people of East Palestine. Does that include paying for their health care needs? All of their health care needs.
Senator, we're going to do what's right for the citizens of East
Palestine. What's right is to cover their health care needs. Will you do that?
Everything is on the table, sir.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In California, at least 8 migrants died after 2 boats capsized off the coast of San Diego Saturday. A woman aboard one of the boats called 911 late that night asking for help. When authorities arrived, they found 2 boats, but no survivors. There are no further details about the victims. Boats attempting to cross from Mexico to the U.S. have become more frequent in recent years as the Biden administration continues to enforce harsh immigration and border policies that have blocked most people from seeking asylum at the southern border and safely enter the United States. Meanwhile, in Europe, over 1,300 people aboard 3 overcrowded migrant boats were rescued off the southern Italian coast Saturday as the death toll from a shipwreck off the shore of Calabria 2 weeks ago has risen to 76. 3 more bodies were found Saturday, including 2 children. That same day, thousands protested near the site of the shipwreck, denouncing Italy's deadly anti-immigrant policies. Meanwhile, at least 30 migrants are missing in the central Mediterranean after their boat capsized Sunday as they fled Libya for Italy. Over a dozen others were rescued by Italian authorities. In Turkey, at least 5 migrants drowned off the country's southwestern coast Saturday as they traveled to Greece on a rubber boat. And in Spain, a group of 48 migrants were rescued Friday off the Canary Islands. Iran and Saudi Arabia agreed to reestablish diplomatic relations in a deal brokered Friday by China and signed in Beijing. The agreement ends a 7-year dispute between the two countries, who plan to reopen their embassies within 2 months. This is Ali Shamkhani, secretary of the Supreme National Security Council of Iran, who represented Tehran at the talks.
At the end of the talks, we reached a conclusion to start a new chapter after 7 years of breaking off relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia. While considering the matters of the two countries and the security and futures of the region, to prevent meddling from extra-regional and Western states and consistent meddling of the Zionist regime in the region.
The news comes at a time of heightened tensions between Washington and Tehran and Washington and Beijing. The White House cautiously welcomed the deal while denying it signaled China's increasing global influence, as National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby said the U.S. would not be stepping back from its role in the Middle East. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers killed 3 Palestinian men in a shootout near Nablus Sunday morning. The violence came a day after an estimated 500,000 people rallied in cities across Israel for a 10th consecutive week of protests against plans by Israel's far-right government to gut the judiciary. Meanwhile, hundreds of demonstrators led by several American Jewish organizations protested a visit by Israel's finance minister to Washington, D.C. Sunday after the Biden Biden administration granted him a diplomatic visa to speak at an investment conference. Bezalel Smotrich was accused of backing a pogrom against Palestinians when he said earlier this month Israel should erase the Palestinian town of Huwara. His comments came just days after Jewish settlers attacked the town, burning cars and homes and killing a Palestinian man. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, at least 19 people were killed Sunday by suspected rebels from the Allied Democratic Forces in the eastern village of Kirindera in North Kivu province. This comes just days after a twin raid in the same region killed at least 36 people. This is a survivor of the attack.
The situation here is catastrophic because of the attack and the damage. Many people died after their throats were cut. Their houses were burned down. And here in the hospital, here where we are standing, even the medicines and all the hospital material was burnt.
The UN is warning of a mounting humanitarian disaster in the DRC as some 300,000 people fled violence in North Kivu province last month. This is UNHCR spokesperson.
UNHCR teams reported the most horrifying testimonies of human rights violations in affected areas, especially in Rutshuru and Masisi territories, including arbitrary killings, kidnapping, extortion, and rapes.
Calls have been mounting for the Rwandan President Paul Kagame to stop supporting M23 rebels, whose attacks have led to the displacement of over 500,000 people, though Rwanda has denied any involvement. The Biden administration said Sunday it'll bar future oil and gas leasing for 3 million acres of federal waters in the Arctic Ocean and will limit drilling in a further 13 million acres in the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska's North Slope. The announcements came as the White House prepared to issue its final decision on the Willow Project, a proposed $8 billion ConocoPhillips oil and gas development in northern Alaska. On Friday, the White House denied reports the administration is prepared to green light the project, saying no final decision has been made. Indigenous and environmental groups have been fighting the project for years. Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with Sikinik Mapin of Sovereign Inupiat for the Living Arctic. Saudi Aramco has reported profits of over $161 billion last year, the largest ever annual profit for any fossil fuel company. Agnès Callamard, the Secretary General of Amnesty International, said the figure is shocking and called on Saudi Arabia, which owns almost all of Saudi Aramco, to phase out fossil fuels and use the exorbitant profits from its oil sales to support human and environmental rights. Other major oil companies also reported record revenues in 2022 as demand surged amidst the war in Ukraine. California residents are bracing for more extreme weather as another atmospheric river has put some 15 million people in California and Nevada under flood watches. In Northern California's Monterey County, the Pajaro River breached a levee over the weekend, triggering an uncontrolled flow of water into the surrounding areas and forcing thousands of people to flee their homes. In Peru, at least 6 people were killed and hundreds of homes damaged or destroyed over the weekend as a powerful cyclone unleashed torrential rains. Elsewhere, Australia's Queensland state experienced record-breaking floods sparked by heavy rain, prompting evacuations. And on Sunday, Cyclone Freddy made landfall in Mozambique for the second time in a month, breaking an all-time record for the longest-lived tropical cyclone and the highest accumulated energy ever observed in a single storm. U.S. banking regulators have taken extraordinary measures to shore up the financial system after a run on Silicon Valley Bank in California last week caused its sudden collapse and sparked fears of financial contagion. The Biden administration says all of Silicon Valley Bank's depositors will have access to their funds today, including uninsured deposits and those exceeding the $250,000 cap set by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The FDIC, the Federal Reserve, and the Treasury Department have taken similar steps to protect depositors at Signature Bank of New York, a major lender to cryptocurrency companies, after its rapid collapse Sunday. These are the second and third largest bank failures in U.S. history. Cecilia Rouse, chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, sought to downplay fears of a wider collapse.
Our banking system is in a fundamentally different place than it was, you know, a decade ago, and that the reforms that were put into place back then really provide the kind of resilience that we'd like to see. So we have every faith in our regulators.
A bill signed by then-President Trump in 2018 rolled back key parts of the Dodd-Frank banking regulations passed after the 2008 financial crisis. 17 Democratic senators and 13 House Democrats sided with Republicans in support of the deregulation, which ended mandates that banks keep more cash and other liquid assets on hand to prevent bank runs. A 2018 law also rolled back stress tests that might have exposed weaknesses at SVB and Signature Bank. SVB's CEO Greg Becker lobbied Congress in 2015 for the rollback of Dodd-Frank. President Biden is addressing this issue in a speech today. In Georgia, an independent autopsy of an activist who was fatally shot by Atlanta police in January concludes their hands were raised when they were killed. Georgia State Patrol shot 26-year-old Manuel Esteban Thuran, known as Tortuguita, as they raided the encampment of forest protectors who've been opposing the construction of Atlanta's $90 million police training center dubbed Cop City. The autopsy, which will be released in full today, also reveals Tortuguita was likely seated cross-legged when shot. Tortuguita's family Friday sued the city of Atlanta after the release of more video evidence of the shooting was blocked. The killing has drawn national attention to Cop City as protests spread across the country. Former Vice President Mike Pence delivered his sharpest criticism yet of former President Trump for his role in the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Pence told attendees at the annual Gridiron Dinner, an elite D.C. event bringing establishment reporters and politicians together, quote, "His reckless words endangered my family and everyone at the Capitol that day, and I know history will hold Donald Trump accountable," Pence said. His remarks came even as he's resisting a federal grand jury subpoena to testify about January 6th. And the 95th Academy Awards were handed out in Los Angeles last night. The Malaysian-born Michelle Yeoh made history as the first Asian woman to win Best Actress for her role in Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, which also won Best Picture.
For all the little boys and girls who look like me watching tonight, this is a beacon of hope and possibilities.
Ke-Huy Quan won Best Supporting Actor for the same film, marking the first time two Asian actors win Oscars in the same year. Ruth Carter became the first Black woman to win two Oscars after she took home the costume design trophy for Black Panther Wakanda Forever last night, 4 years after winning for Black Panther. The winner of Best Documentary was Navalny, about the Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, his poisoning, imprisonment and his anti-corruption movement. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at a new agreement between Iran and Saudi Arabia to reestablish diplomatic relations after a seven-year rift. The deal was reached after 4 days of secret talks in Beijing in a sign of China's growing diplomatic power in the Middle East. As part of the deal, Iran and Saudi Arabia have agreed to reopen their embassies within 2 months. China's top diplomat Wang Yi called the agreement a victory for peace.
I think this is a victory for dialogue, a victory for peace, offering significant good news for today's turbulent world.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres praised the deal, saying, quote, "Good neighborly relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia are essential for the stability of the Gulf region." The response in Washington was more muted. White House National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby said the Biden administration supports any effort to de-escalate tensions in the region, but he questioned if Iran is going to, quote, "meet their obligations." Ali Shamkhani, the secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, spoke Friday in Beijing.
At the end of the talks, we reached a conclusion to start a new chapter after 7 years of breaking off relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia. while considering the matters of the two countries and the security and futures of the region, to prevent meddling from extra-regional and Western states and consistent meddling of the Zionist regime in the region. We hope that this new chapter will compensate for the stagnation of relations that took place these last 7 years, and also leads to stability and security in the region, as well as the development and welfare of all its peoples.
We're joined right now by Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Trita, welcome back to Democracy Now! Start off by your response to this thawing of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia and where it took place, these secret talks in Beijing.
Really significant development in the region, not only because the Saudis and the Iranians have come to terms on a normalization, which hopefully will be used to reduce their tensions and as a result bring down tensions in other countries in which the Saudis and the Iranians are fighting each other, but also because of the fact that China stepped in and brought this deal over the goal line. It had already been prepared for more than 2 years by the Iraqis and the Omanis, but they had not managed to get it over the goal line that Chinese did. This is major development because China has so far not shown any interest or ability to be able to play that type of a diplomatic role in the region. Now it has. It has been successful, and it is sending shockwaves throughout the region and beyond.
So talk about the role of China in negotiating this secret deal. Or at least the secret talks, not secret deal anymore.
Well, the Chinese were able to play this role for a couple of very simple reasons. First of all, they actually have excellent relations with both the Iranians and the Saudis. Unlike the United States, the Chinese have retained a neutral position on their conflict. They worked very hard and with great discipline to not get themselves entangled into the conflicts that the various regional powers have with each other, and as a result, have been in this position to be able to play this role. It's also noteworthy that China had this diplomatic influence without having a single military base in the region, without being the main arms provider of any of these countries, or without providing any security guarantees to any of these countries, which is usually the American model for mediation, which we're seeing less and less of. If this then now means that the Chinese are going to play a greater role beyond this issue, then that would without a doubt be a very, very important development. And there's signs that that is the Chinese ambition. It is not just a normalization deal. The Chinese want to hold a summit between Iran and the GCC countries, the Arab states of the Persian Gulf, in Beijing later this year. This could be the first steps towards a fundamental different security architecture in the region.
President Biden was asked about the deal on Friday as he was leaving a press briefing.
What are your thoughts on Saudi Arabia and Iran reestablishing diplomatic relations, sir?
Better the relations between Israel and the Arab neighbors, the better for everyone.
National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby also commented on the deal in an interview with Chuck Todd on Meet the Press.
Anything that can bring the tensions down in the region is welcome, Chuck. And if this can help us end that war in Yemen, if it can help the Saudi people feel more comfortable that they're not going to be attacked from Houthi rebels that are supported by Iran, then we welcome that. It remains to be seen how sustainable this is going to be. We've seen Iran enter into agreements before, make commitments that that they actually don't follow through on. We actually hope they do. We hope this does work to de-escalate tensions.
Do you think you're going to close this deal between Israel and Saudi Arabia? And do you think this deal with Iran makes it harder or easier for the Israelis to do that?
We certainly want to see Israel more integrated into the Middle East. We support the Abraham Accords, Chuck, and we want to see that integration continue. One of the reasons why the president went to the Middle East last summer was to help move that process along. You saw just recently Oman opened up their airspace to flights to and from Israel. That's an outgrowth of that trip that the president made. Of course, we got the Red Sea Islands deal done. So we've made a lot of progress on that. We want to see that integration deepen and broaden. Yeah. Now, whether or not this Iran-Saudi Arabia deal, how that affects that, I think, remains to be seen. But it doesn't change our focus on trying to see Israel more integrated into the region.
Your response, Trita Parsi, to all that, both what John Kirby said and President Biden.
I'm not sure if the president heard a question right, because answering about the U.S.'s effort on the Abraham Accords and Israel's integration in response to that question obviously seems to suggest a dismissive notion. But as we saw John say on TV later on, the U.S. welcomes this development because it ultimately can bring down tensions in the region. And I think that is truly an important point, because even though there's a lot of nervousness right now in Washington about China stepping in to the diplomatic vacuum that the United States itself has left by disabling itself from being able to play the role of a mediator in many of these different conflicts, the reality nevertheless is that if we have a more stable Middle East, even if it's mediated by the Chinese, that ultimately is good for the United States as well. The U.S.'s focus has almost singularly been on the Abraham Accord. And the Abraham Accord does bring about better relations between some of the GCC states and Saudi Arabia and Israel, but does absolutely nothing to bring about a resolution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, which is the actual real problem that needs to be resolved. It signals that the United States has essentially moved beyond even having the ambition to be able to help. And that would be one thing. But reality is that the Abrams Accord actually is helping cement that conflict and making sure that it cannot make any progress, because all of the pressure is taken off of Israel to end its occupation of the Palestinian territories by moving forward on normalization with other countries. So the incentives for the Israelis to move in the direction in which actually would resolve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is removed by the Abrams Accord. And for what? For, you know, direct flights between various countries, et cetera. It seems to me a very odd trade-off. And it's, again, part of the reason why I think more and more countries are no longer looking towards Washington to help resolve some of these disputes. But potentially now we're going to see a trend in which the eyes were going to be turned towards Beijing.
Can you talk about the Iran GCC summit that's going to be held in China? Scheduled for China later this year. The significance of the meeting being held there, what are the key issues expected? And also China's role as, well, major trader with both countries, that's at T-R-A-D-E-R, but the biggest consumer of Gulf oil, the largest purchaser of Iran's oil.
Well, again, we have to be very clear. This is what the Chinese are proposing. We don't know yet if the Iranians and the GCC states all have accepted. I suspect they will. We don't know how ambitious the agenda is going to be. There's a lot of unknowns. But the mere fact that it's been suggested, the mere fact that there's a high likelihood that these countries will accept, is in and of itself very significant. The Persian Gulf is one of the few areas in the world that does not have any security architecture at all. And to have China step in and move towards building something along those lines is going to be a very significant development, particularly if it does not bring about arms sales, does not bring about security guarantees, but is actually helping the region build its own security architecture and be its own guarantors of that. That would be a very different approach from what we've seen so far. It would fill a vacuum that can bring about far greater stability in the region. And from the Chinese perspective, the key reason why this is important to them is because they are in dire need of the energy in the Persian Gulf, and they need stability in the Persian Gulf. It is also important for them, it appears, that as U.S.-China tensions are increasing and the United States is increasingly moving towards trying to contain China, by China playing this type of a diplomatic role elsewhere in the world and showing itself to be constructive, perhaps indispensable, that will make it all the more difficult for the United States to contain.
We're talking to Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Talk about how this decision and the deal has been received in South Asia, in the Middle East.
Well, throughout the Middle East, it's been welcomed from countries such as Lebanon to Yemen to Iraq, Saudi Arabia, of course, the UAE, Qatar, Bahrain. The only country that really has stood out in opposition to this has been Israel in the region. And we've seen statements by Yair Lapid, for instance, the opposition leader, who blames this on Netanyahu, calls this a very dangerous development, and others. And I think this is because of their fear that this normalization between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and it will now mean that the Saudis will be far less interested or drive a harder bargain for it to normalize relations with Israel and join the Abrams support. The issue, though, is that this doesn't need to be an either-or. Saudi Arabia can have normal relations with Iran and later on also move towards normalizing relations with Israel. What is the main obstacle there, I think, ultimately, is that unless the Israelis move towards a real peace and a two-state solution, it will always be a difficult position and decision for the Saudis to move towards normalization. Polls have shown that even though the Saudi population are open to having trade with Israel, they're not open to normalization unless there is a two-state solution and a Palestinian state.
And
this is not a minor issue for the Saudi population. This is not a public transportation issue. This is an issue that carries a tremendous amount of emotional potential. So even though I think the Saudi crown prince is eager to normalize and has been indicating that, this is an issue that he has to be very careful about, because having the Saudi population completely be against it will be a problem for him if he goes forward without any movement on the Israeli side towards peace.
And what does this mean for Yemen, Trita?
Well, that's where I think the hopes are high, that as a result of Saudi Arabia and Iran normalizing, agreeing to not interfere in each other's internal affairs, which from the Saudi perspective means that the Iranians stop supporting the Houthis, and that it will bring pressure onto the Houthis, that there will be a higher likelihood now that the truce that is in place has expired, but is still abided by largely by both sides, will now be able to be extended and potentially move towards a more permanent settlement between the two sides. Whether the Iranians have that influence over the Houthis or not remains to be seen. I think it's largely been exaggerated. So now the Iranians need to deliver on that front. But people I've spoken to are very hopeful about this, because even though the conflict in Yemen has its internal roots, it has been fueled significantly by the competition and rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
And finally, what do you think this means, China negotiating this deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia? Could China play a similar role between Russia and Ukraine?
Well, it's very interesting that you mentioned that, because the Chinese, of course, first, a couple of weeks ago, launched this idea of them mediating between Russia and Ukraine, and it was not received particularly well in the West. Even before it came out, the proposal was essentially poo-pooed. And then when it came out, it didn't appear to contain that much. Reality is that I think down the road, the Chinese very well could play that role, because they do have leverage over Russia, which is something the United States does not in the same way. Again, we're talking about a conflict in which the U.S. is clearly on one side. The Chinese, from the U.S. perspective, are on the Russian side because they have not taken the Ukrainian side. But I don't think that's necessarily how the Russians do it. More than anything else, I think what's important here to realize, we are now in a multipolar world. And in that multipolar world, powers such as China, down the road, India, are going to play a more important role, perhaps a leading role, when it comes to diplomacy and conflict resolution. Our approach from the American side, I think, should be to flexibly adjust to this and welcome the positives that come with that, rather than seeing that as a negative and dangerous development, that it would be a threat to us. I think the threat would come if we continue to pursue approach, particularly in the Middle East, in which we're constantly taking sides and as a result become part of the problem rather than part of the solution. If the new normal is that other countries look towards China for peacemaking and America for war making, that would be a threat. But it doesn't have to be that way. It's in our hands to be able to change it.
Trita Parsi, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and author of a number of books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Next up, we go to North Pole, Alaska, as President Biden moves to approve a massive oil and gas development known as the Willow Project in northern Alaska. Stay with us.
Yuli Amman, Yuli Yuri Ama, Aushangan. Yuri Ama, Yuri Ama, Yuri Ama, Aushangan.
Stars help to make us strong, to mix our lives and to make them one. Remember.